Today's Teisho will be on case 25. Case 25 is entitled Kyozan's Dream. In a dream, Kyozan Osho went to Maitreya's palace and was led to sit in the third seat. A senior monk struck with a gavel and said, "Today the one in the third seat will speak." Kyozan rose and, striking with the gavel, said, "The truth of Mahayana is beyond the four propositions and transcends the 100 negations. Tai Cho, hear the truth." Mumon's comment, "Now tell me, did Kyozan preach or did he not? If he opens his mouth, he is lost. If he closes his mouth, he is lost. If he neither opens nor closes his mouth, he is 108,000 miles away from the truth." Mumon's verse, "In broad daylight, under the blue sky, he forges a dream in a dream. He makes up a monstrous story and tries to deceive the whole crowd." Thank you very much for coming to practice Zen on this beautiful fall day. This week I was at a meeting of people who are involved in undergraduate education at Rutgers. And this included a dean of undergraduate education and a number of department chairs and other people who are involved, people from student life or student services. And one of the topics of discussion was that the enrollments in humanities and social sciences were declining very quickly. There has been a decline, sort of a gradual decline, in the number of students who take courses in English or history or art history or philosophy. This decline has been going on for a long time. Fewer students are taking courses in anthropology and sociology and a number of other disciplines. So we were talking about this problem, that what has been a sort of a gradual decline in some areas has just become like dropping off a cliff. So, for example, I understand that the history department has seen a 25% drop in enrollments this year. So that, if you're in the history department and 25% of your students are gone, you're going to be panic-stricken if you're paying attention. And we were asking, why is it that the students are just not interested in, say, reading really exciting novels or asking what is the meaning of life, what is life all about, or going and looking at some of the most beautiful artwork in the history of the world? Why? These are 17-year-old people, 18-year-old people. They're coming to college, and apparently they don't want to learn about Van Gogh, or they don't want to study anthropology and learn about the Yanomamo, or Sherpas, or the Naruba. Apparently, they're not interested. You know? And I must say, this has been caused a lot of consternation in my own department. It's like, you know, we have these novels, over in English, we have these novels that are really good novels, you know. Some of the greatest thinkers who have ever lived have written novels, and they're wonderful. If you read them, they're most exciting. And, you know, one of the people on the committee was an art historian, and she, her specialty is the Renaissance, you know, so Michelangelo, Leonardo, pretty special stuff. And a little bit we feel like we're going to have to go out on the street and try to grab students and drag them into our classes. Come here and look at this beautiful painting from the Renaissance. And they'll be texting, I guess. So, you know, we're worried about it. And we had some people who are like specialists in this area, and they said, look, you don't understand. Students are coming to Rutgers today, and they have to borrow $50,000 or $60,000 to go to college, maybe. You know, some of them. Some of them $20,000, $30,000. You know, they're very worried about getting a good job. Very worried. You know, they feel if they're coming to college and they're spending all this money, they don't have time to read Shakespeare. They don't have time to study, you know, the newer, or to learn about world systems theory. They've got to get a good job. And so they're not going to take a course on the French Impressionists. You know, they're just not, some of them anyway. I mean, there's still some students in there, but the decline is really frightening. She says these students are taking a lot of classes just because they're thinking about their future employment. So they all want to get into the business school. They all want to get into pharmacy. They all want to get into one of these other professional schools. So they have when they graduate, they'll be handed a diploma, and the next day they can start their job. This is the way they think. And it's hard to be mad at the students. You know, it's hard to be mad at these students because this is the world they live in. You know, their parents apparently are very, very skeptical about their children majoring in the humanities. A dean who works with parents said, you know, they come here, they say, I want my son to get a job. You know, they can read Shakespeare on their own time, right? So this is sort of the spirit. And another person who was like a psychologist said something so interesting. She said, you know, the way these kids have been raised from very early on, they have been very controlled lives. So she said, you know, she is about my age, and she said, children so often now don't experience like a lot of free time. She said, you know, a lot of these kids have highly structured childhoods. So, you know, they have a soccer class they get off of school, and then mom has to drive them to the soccer class or a soccer game. And then they have another event and another, and they go from structured event to structured event. And she said, these young people who are coming to college now have this way of thinking about things. Everything has a structure. Everything has a purpose. And when they come to college, they sort of carry that spirit with them. Now, it's not everybody, right? It's not everybody. But it really got me to thinking, you know. When I was a kid, it wasn't like this, you know. I had a lot of unstructured time when I was growing up. My mother would just basically take us to the door and throw us out the door. And recently I was reading, a friend of mine gave me a book of Calvin and Hobbes cartoons. I don't know if you know Calvin and Hobbes, but I highly recommend the cartoons. They're really wonderful. It's a story of this little boy and his pet. He has like a stuffed tiger. But in his imagination, the tiger is his best friend. So in the comic strip, it always shows the little boy talking to this giant tiger who follows him around. But one of the things that makes the comic strip so funny is that his mom throws him out of the house, and he spends the whole day just entertaining himself with his imagination. And he gets in all kinds of trouble, of course. You know, he decides to throw water balloons on people as they pass the house. He gets filthy dirty digging a fort in the ground. And all of these things reminded me of my own childhood. We had a lot of unstructured time. Just to walk or outside. When we lived in Baltimore, there was a big park right next to our apartment complex, and I would go out there and spend the whole day. My brother would be out there all day. He would come home at night, and we would be sitting around the dinner table, and my mother would say, "Well, Peter, what happened out in the woods?" And he'd say, "I saw a dinosaur." And, "Oh, that's wonderful, you know, a dinosaur." But I think my brother wasn't lying. I think he really thought he might have seen, you know, like the tail of a dinosaur slithering through the trees. So this was a really rich way to grow up. And I do think maybe that this psychologist has a point, you know, that our society has become very, very highly structured. Very, very highly structured. And basically people can feel like they're very locked in, you know, very locked in to, like, you know, when I was a teenager, I was very disorganized. And my father always used to say to me, "Kurt, you've got to get with the program." I don't know if parents say that to their kids anymore, but my father was a big believer in the program. I didn't really understand the program, but now I do. You know, there is like a program. And I think it means, you know, basically you have to be at this place at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and at this place at 6, and at this place at 7. And I think little kids now are socialized into a very highly structured society. And I think it's even more difficult for little kids because, you know, in school now, there's testing. They have these standardized tests. Maybe I'm describing a world you know. But, you know, there's even going to be like a second grade test. I'm actually on a committee that represents higher education and in the state. And when I heard that there was going to be a second grade test, I almost started screaming. But I didn't want to get thrown out and disgrace Rutgers, so I didn't start screaming. But it made me very upset. And so kids have these very structured lives, and then they go to school, and there's all these standardized tests. You know, for me, reading books was so enjoyable because there was no time. There was no expectation of anything being, like getting anything out of it. You know? So when I would read a book, you know, one of the books, I used to love science fiction. And I loved Ursula Le Guin. When I was a kid, I read a lot of Ursula Le Guin's books. And, you know, she has these civilizations on other planets that are fascinating, you know. And I would just walk around all day dreaming that I was living in this alternative planet, you know. And I never thought, what am I getting out of this experience, you know? So I think our culture has really changed, you know. I think we live in a world where there's a lot of pressures on people, and we're highly controlled, and life is highly structured. And so, you know, maybe it's no coincidence that I was at another meeting recently where a bunch of people from student life were talking about how rates of depression and psychological dysfunction have gone up among college students. Apparently, larger and larger percentages of students are presenting kinds of problems, psychological problems. And at Rutgers, psychological services is really overwhelmed with all the problems they're facing. So, you know, I do think this is a problem, and I think it's symptomatic of sort of like the way we live our lives in the modern world. I'm on a subscriber list for a magazine called Buddhism and Culture. I didn't ask for the magazine, but it was sent to me. And it's printed in Korea. And I came back from my meeting where we were talking about how it's getting hard to get students to read books or go to see great art. And there was a story about, there was a story in this magazine about this Tibetan meditation master who came to visit a temple in Korea. And he said something that I thought was so wonderful. And I just wanted to read you a piece of it because I thought it was very important for understanding what Zen practice is all about. He said, how should we plan our life? He said, how should we plan our life? What should our aim be? And this is Tibetan monk. He said, first, we should all have fun. He said, Buddhism does not oppose having fun. Second, we should all have money to have fun. Buddhism does not really oppose money either. Third, in order to have fun and money, we need to have self-discipline. Buddhism definitely offers many methods for increasing your self-discipline. Most modern people understand this much. True Buddhist wisdom comes fourth. Okay. He said, you should have fun, you should have money, and you should have discipline. He said, no problem. Buddhism doesn't have any problem with those. He said, but there's the fourth thing you need to know is that none of these are going to work out for you. He said, true Buddhist wisdom comes from the fourth. At the end, none of these works. There is really no fun, no money, no discipline, and everything is actually an illusion. This is not what you hear when you study for an MBA, because that teaches you common sense. They are not interested in wisdom. The quaint essence of the Buddha Dharma is to teach you this wisdom. So we have greed for many things, for power, for possessions, and for communication with other people. We have also achieved many things. People in Seoul can drink fresh juice made from kiwi fruit picked in New Zealand yesterday. Is this an achievement? From the material consumer point of view, probably yes. He said, but there is so much destruction to the world and also to your health to maintain this achievement. From this point of view, we have different definitions of what usefulness is. We all strive to become useful human beings. Many parents terrorize their children so that they will be useful adults. Being useful has many meanings in the so-called modern world. He said, however, if you practice Buddhism, your journey is to master uselessness. So to become a Buddhist means that you will become a perfectly useless person. When you are useless to the world, then you are not busy. Then you are not stressed. And you can be relaxed. A relaxed and unstressed person sees the truth more readily. It takes great daring and courage to become truly useless. You know, I think there is a great wisdom in these words. You know, we see ourselves as we believe that if we accomplish something that other people want us to accomplish, we will be happy. We will be happy, and we grow up in this society encouraged to think this way. So, you know, I can remember when I was a kid, when I was in school, I was failing algebra. Algebra 1 was very difficult for me. And I was failing the class, and I would take home these failing grades, and my parents were very unhappy with me. And my father, he was really, really upset that I was getting these bad grades. So I was not allowed to watch TV. I wasn't allowed to go out and play with my friends. And so I really began to study very hard, and I did get really good at algebra. In fact, I got in the second part of the semester of the year, I got straight A's. So I failed the whole first half of the year. And in the second half, I got straight A's. And my parents were so happy with me, and I felt so glad that they were happy with me. But you know, a little later in my life, I began to develop sort of like a personality disorder, you could say. Because, you know, when I got that A, it felt so wonderful to be approved of. I felt that my parents finally loved me because I was getting good grades. And so I wanted to be loved, you know, and so I wanted to get really good grades. And indeed, you know, I turned into a real grinder, you know. I don't know if you have that expression anymore, but I would study, and I would get straight A's and all the time, all the way through. So, you know, when other kids were out having fun, I would be studying trigonometry or studying geography, and I would just get A's on all these tests, you know. Every once in a while, I would slip up, and I wouldn't get an A. I would get like a B or B plus. And I would actually sort of like be ill. I would be so disappointed in myself, you know, And I've been talking to people who are like in psychological services, and they say many, many students now at Rutgers are like this. You know, they have an idea of how they want their life to be. You know, they want to be a doctor. You know, parents say, if you are a doctor, that would be wonderful, which really means in a way, you know, you love your kids and you want them to do well. But, you know, they might hear this as, if you become a doctor, we will really, really, really love you, you know. And so, you know, these kids are coming to Rutgers and they want to be a doctor and they're in pre-med classes. And maybe, you know, Rutgers is a little harder than some than high school, you know. So, you know, maybe on your first test you get, instead of getting your 98, you get a 68. And these people from Student Life tell me that these students just fall apart. You know, they fall apart. You know, and I think part of this is because they don't have the inner resources to deal with defeat and difficulty. You know, they're clinging very tightly to this image of who they should be and what they should do. And, you know, in many ways, our whole culture is like this. You know, we're very, 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 very driven to be successful, to be, to reach high goals. You know, there's nothing wrong with having goals, but it can become a kind of a prison house, I think, you know. What I think these young people need is something like Zazen. I mean, obviously. But I think something like Zazen would really help them. Zazen is all about becoming a useless human being. And I think that word useless makes many people very nervous. You know, if we said, if the Dalai Lama doesn't go around saying Buddhism will make you totally useless, you know, If you look at how Buddhism is marketed in the United States, it's often marketed in terms of how it will make you successful, you know. So, you know, I don't know if you are aware of this, but there's an online news aggregator called the Huffington Post. And the editor of the Huffington Post is a woman named Huffington. And Arianna Huffington. And Arianna Huffington meditates. And Arianna Huffington has a column in her Huffington Post. And she sometimes talks about meditation, and she talks about all of these corporate leaders who do meditation. And they all talk about how useful meditation is, how it makes them able to work longer hours, and so on and so on. I'm really happy meditation helps them to work longer hours. That's great. You know, please do. I myself work more a lot long hours too. And sometimes I do sit down on the cushion, I'm really wiped out, and I sit down on the cushion and I feel better and I can grade some more papers or write something more. So that's good. But you know, we miss the forest for the trees if we don't realize that, you know, that's a kind of very narrow way to live. Ultimately, probably very unhappy way to live. You know, the Italians have a wonderful saying. It's called dolce fa niente, the sweetness of doing nothing. Sweetness of doing nothing. And, you know, in some ways, you know, I think Zazen is all about dolce fa niente, the sweetness of doing nothing. You know, I do believe that doing nothing is incredibly important and incredibly liberating. You know, when we have a goal, we say, I'm going to go from point A to point B. So often in life, we can't get to point B. You know, this is so often the case. You know, so, you know, I even had a student a few years ago whose brother was like a star. He was an absolutely top of his class student here at Rutgers. And he went into medical school on an accelerated program. And, you know, naturally, when he graduated, his parents came to his graduation, and they hugged him. They were so happy. So his younger sister, who I know, you know, she wanted to be just like her brother. She wanted to, you know, be an excellent student, go to an accelerated medical school, you know, program. She would have a graduation. The parents would put their arms around her and say, "You are so wonderful." But you know, chemistry just wasn't her thing. She just couldn't do it. She began to get very unhappy, very depressed. You know, this goal that she had was in the distance, and she could see it so clearly, but she couldn't get to it. And this failure to be able to reach her goal caused her more and more distress, more and more tension and anxiety. And really like self-hatred. This is so common, right? This is so human. Now look, you know, while you're at point A and you're heading towards point B, and as you're going towards point B, all this stuff is happening to you, you know. And if you're too focused on point B, you know, you don't notice it. And you don't realize how wonderful this all is as it unfolds around you. You know, really being alive requires us to have no purpose. Even thinking requires us to have no purpose. You know, when I was in high school, our teacher, Mrs. Brown, I had a wonderful teacher in the 10th grade, Mrs. Brown. She was a really good English teacher. We would write these essays, and she would take her red pen and she would cover them with red ink. And we would all go home and cry, you know. You know, when we got to college, we were very well prepared. She really made us work hard and think. But, you know, one of the things Mrs. Brown used to do that I don't agree with was she always used to make us write an outline. So before I would start writing, I would have to write an outline. And I would write the outline, and then I would start writing. But, you know, when I would start writing, it would never follow the outline. My brain just wouldn't do what the outline said. You know, I would start thinking, and my thinking would, I'd think of this, and then I'd think of this, and I'd think of this, and I'd think of this. And I wanted to control my thinking so much and make it follow the outline, but it never did. You know, and what I would actually wind up doing is writing the paper and then writing the outline after, and telling her I'd written it first. She said, "Oh, you followed your outline so well." You know, I have to tell you the truth, I was a really good writer. You know, in high school, I always got A's. And it wasn't just because I was trying to get A's, I actually enjoyed it. And it was because, you know, you just start thinking and you see where it's going to go. And being open, I think being a good writer is really about being open to the possibilities as they unfold spontaneously. See, this comes from being useless. See, being useless. I teach classes. I teach class every day, pretty much. And I used to have a lesson plan. I used to come into my class and I'd have a lesson plan. And I would think, okay, we're going to discuss this, 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 and this. And at the end of the class, this is where we're going to wind up. Okay. So, you know, when I started teaching, I really tried to teach like this. But, you know, the teaching became this incredibly stressful and unpleasant experience. Because I would come in and I would say, okay, I'm going to cover this first. And I'd start covering it. And then somebody would stick up her hand or his hand and ask me a question, and pretty soon the conversation would totally derail my plan. And the conversation would go in some crazy direction. And, you know, 80 minutes was gone, and I hadn't even gotten halfway through my plan, and during the whole conversation I'd be getting more and more tense, right? So I'd be thinking, we're not covering the material. Now, you know, actually, at some point, for years and years, I never connected my Zen practice with anything else I did. You know, so I would come in and sit and feel better, but I never thought this might have something to do with my life. But, you know, it did occur to me that maybe I shouldn't worry about my lesson plan. You know, and then, you know, you come into class and you start talking about something that the students have read. And you learn a lot about the students. You learn about what they don't know. And you can have this really stimulating conversation that can get them to where they need to be, but by a route you can't really predict, you know? I hope this is making some sense. So, you know, I don't go into class anymore with a lesson plan. It's just like, let's see what happens. Let's see what happens. And if I don't worry about getting something out of the 80 minutes, usually everybody learns a lot, I think. And I learn a lot, and I enjoy it. It's like the adventure, right? The adventure. You're in a classroom with 23 other people, and they all have interesting things to say if you give them half a chance, you know. And I have interesting things to say, you know. And so let's just see what happens. You know, I really think this is a wonderful way to live. You know, it's a wonderful way to live. You know, when we sit on the cushion, we're learning how to be open. We're learning how not to have a plan. We're learning how to be available to the universe, if you want to put it that way. You know, Zen does require a discipline. You know, you have to show up. If you don't show up, nothing is going to happen. You know, so if you sit every other day, you know, if you stop sitting every other day, you're not going to have a practice. You have to be disciplined. You know, I get up every day and meditate. You know, and I love it. You know, I get up every day and I meditate, but it's hard. It's hard to get up at 5 o'clock sometimes. I like to sleep in, you know. But I do it. I drag myself out and I sit down. You can never predict what's going to happen when you sit. You sit down on the cushion, and you if you're watching the breath, you know, one day you just have this wonderful sit. You know, you're sitting, you're watching your breath, and then all of a sudden, you know, you feel this sense of harmony or connectedness or well-being, this powerful sense of even like joy. And, you know, it's like, where did that come from? You get off the cushion, you go home, you say, tomorrow I'm going to do some more sitting. You sit down on the cushion, you wait for the joy, you wait, doesn't come. You know, this is an elementary lesson of Zen practice. You know, you can't make things happen. You know, you usually have a good sit if you have no expectations, you know. You just present yourself, you show up, and you see what happens. You see what happens. You know, this is a wonderful, a very important lesson about the value of uselessness. You know, consciousness, what we call consciousness from the Zen point of view, is not really that important. So the mind that plans and has expectations and so on is really not a very important part of who we are. From the Zen point of view, who we are is really mostly unconscious. It's below the threshold of our consciousness. And so Zen is all about living with that unconsciousness close to us. So, you know, when you sit down on the cushion, your busy, discriminating mind becomes quiet. And it's like you approach a kind of silence or emptiness. And you wait for that emptiness or silence. You wait with it. And something happens. Who knows what's going to happen? A lot of Zazen is just being patient and waiting for the stirrings of this deeper mind, you know. I have many times had situations where I felt like I was completely boxed in, you know, completely boxed in. You know, I will have a problem with something I'm working on, and maybe something I'm writing, or a problem at work, you know. Maybe there's some issue where, you know, there's a person in my department who is very, very difficult to deal with. Very difficult. And, you know, sometimes I just feel like I don't know how to handle this person. And, you know, I will have a very frustrating day working with this person, and I will come home and sit down on the cushion. And I don't really expect anything. You know, I'm just trying to be useless. And I sit down on the cushion, and sometimes, you know, I get off the cushion, I realize this is what I have to do. I know how to solve my problem now. You know, and I think it's because I'm making myself available to my big unconscious mind, you know. And so, you know, one way to understand what Zen practice is yes, it does require discipline. But it's also living very close to that bigger mind, which we experience as a kind of emptiness or a kind of openness, or uselessness. You know, I've been doing meditation for 35 years, I come into the meditation hall, into this room sometime. And, you know, I'm really beaten up from the day, you know. It's tiring, I have stressful challenges and so on. And, you know, I sit down on the cushion and it's so liberating to be useless. It's so freeing to be useless. And when I get off the cushion, I usually feel like 10 years younger, and I feel like I can solve my problems, you know. Because I'm not taking my problems too seriously. You know? people in our culture live in a very strange way, actually. You know, I don't think we're particularly wise people. You know, we have this sense that we have to be, doing things, changing things all the time. You know, I was listening to a radio show, and they were interviewing, 10th graders. And these young boys and girls all said, you know, when I grow up, I want to change the world. I want to change the world. And they all said it. I want to change the world. And it's like, really? Why do you want to do that? You know. I'm not sure that's a healthy aspiration. Actually, I think it's good to help others. I'm not saying we shouldn't try to help others, but I think there's a kind of a delusion there, or a kind of a self-deceit there. You know, it's really like the ego is talking. I don't want to. How shall I put it? You know, someday, if human beings live long enough. If human beings live long enough, somebody's going to say, somebody's going to say, do you know there used to be a place called New Jersey? Yeah? And they'll go, I've never heard of New Jersey. That must have been a long time ago. Yeah? And people will say, you know, there used to be a place called the United States. Yeah? Somebody will go, really? I don't believe that. You know? Where was that? You know, someday, you know, if we live long enough, people will say, "Have you ever heard of New Jersey, of China? Did you?" Someday, if we live long enough, people will say, "Have you ever heard of Shakespeare?" And they'll say, "Shakespeare, never heard of him." Probably most of what we do is not going to be permanent. It's not going to be permanent. You know. New Jersey is going to be here for a while, and it's going to be gone. You know, I work in an English department, and I have written a couple books. And you know, every once in a while, I'll go to the library and just take my book out and dust it off. You know, and you know, it's in a shelf full of dusty books, right? And the library is full of dusty books, right? I have to tell you, the first book took me 5 years to write, and the second book took me 8 years to write. But they're covered with dust, right? Now you could say, oh, how tragic, how sad. And there is a certain way in which it's tragic and sad, but you know, there's another way in which it's incredibly liberating. Incredibly liberating. You know, so what is life all about? You know, but you know, we could say, well, life is about getting from point A to point B, you know. But on the other hand, maybe it's not. You know, maybe life is about being open to the possibilities. You know, nothing is. You know, the Buddhist teaching is nothing lasts. You know, the great Zen teacher, Suzuki Roshi, Shunri of Suzuki Roshi. He was asked, what is the essence of Buddhism? And he said, nothing lasts, you know, nothing lasts. So, you know, we so often think, I need to, you know, if I do this, it will be finally, you know, finally something will be achieved. I want to achieve something with my life. Finally, I'll have something to show for my life. See, and it really, I hate to put it this way, but the Buddhist idea is no, you won't. You won't. At the end, it will all be gone. You know, it'll all be gone. That doesn't mean it's not worth doing, but it's worth doing for a different reason. Right? Someday people are going to say, Brad Pitt, who was he? I never heard of him, right? Tom Cruise, never heard of him, right? So maybe the point in life is not to create something that's going to last forever. Maybe the point in life is not to reach a goal, but really and truly the point of life is to be useless. You know, being totally useless might be the most wonderful thing in the world. And, you know, I think if we're totally useless, we can be very, very alert and very, very compassionate. You know, a few years ago, I was really stunned to see something with some graduate students in my department. We used to have a research course where students would have to look for books. They would have to go to the library and find a book in the library. It was like a research methods course. And it appears that a graduate student had found the book, and then, in order not to let other graduate students find it, had basically put the book in a very different place where nobody else could find it. So in other words, the graduate student had actually sabotaged the other graduate students. And at first, everybody was so upset about this. It was like, oh my God, we can't believe that this is happening, you know. That what happened to the spirit of comradeship and so on with our graduate students? But you know, I think we send people messages that encourage this kind of behavior, you know. And my feeling is that, you know, when you say, you know, get to point A, from point A to point B, that's what life is all about. You know, we encourage a kind of unhelpful mindset. You know, if we say, look, nothing is really that important. Nothing we do in our lives is really going to last. You know, suddenly I think we become really sensitive to the people around us. You know, we're not in such a hurry. It's not so important to do anything in particular. And we begin to pay attention to, you know, really just this wonderful day. You know, this wonderful life. Hyozan's dream. In a dream, Hyozan Osho went to Maitreya's palace, went to the Buddha's palace, and was led in to sit in the third seat. This is like a dream, right? This Hyozan Osho, priest Osho, goes to the palace of the Buddha. The Buddha doesn't really have a palace, but in his dream, he's led to sit in the third seat, like a place of honor. A senior monk, struck with a gavel, and said, "Today, the one in the third seat will speak." Hyozan rose and, striking with the gavel, said, "The truth of the Mahayana is beyond the four propositions and transcends the 100 negations." And it says, "Hear the truth, hear the truth." So Mumon says, "Now tell me, did Kyozan preach or did he not? In other words, What did Kyozan achieve? If he opens his mouth, he's lost. If he closes his mouth, he's lost. Even if he neither opens nor shuts his mouth, he is 108,000 miles away from the truth." Okay, now, uh, 108 in Buddhism is the number of perfection, actually. So in Buddhism, you'll see some priests and monks have long strings of beads around their neck. There's 108 beads. 108 means perfection, or perfection. So he said, even if he opens his mouth or shuts it, he's 108,000 miles away from the truth. In other words, always, always where you should be. You're always where you should be. It's always perfect. It's always perfect. Mumon's verse. In broad daylight, under the blue sky, he forges a dream in a dream. This is human beings, right? In broad daylight, under the blue sky, he forges a dream in a dream. He makes up a monstrous story and tries to deceive the whole crowd. So what does it mean to wake up? You know, I think what it means to wake up is this experience of real freedom. And we sit down on the cushion and we have a purpose when we start. But by the end of 25 minutes, you know, the whole concept of purpose disappears, and the moment becomes all enveloping, at least when we are sitting well. And I think that's real freedom. We can take that off the cushion, too, into our lives. And if we can have just a little bit of this spirit, dolce fa niente, uselessness, we remind ourselves as we go through our day to be a little more useless today. You know, I think it will be a better world.